true, which is that when he was mentioning, it was some small newspaper that had a report of Thomas Paine's death and the services being held from him and so forth. And I was consulting it as I was going around New York City developing this book. And he'd asked me, you know, did you in fact have that newspaper? And I do. It's still in my office at home. But I found it on eBay. So that's that's how these things tend to come about. I have I rely quite a bit on chance finds among old books and old newspapers, but actually finding that material is very reliant on search technology. And for me, most of the writing that I do couldn't have existed 10 or 20 years ago, or if it had, it would have taken decades to compile. And it's not because I write about current events. It's because I write about stuff that is so obscure or in some cases kind of unclassifiable or so obscure that no one would have bothered to classify it or index it that it would have been impossible to find in the past. And for me, the existence of being able to search large databases of books and newspapers and other documents has really radically altered my capacity to work with history. Just to give you an example of this, I did a piece a little while back for New Scientist magazine about something called the Trico system. The Trico system was a business that operated in the 20s and 30s in illicit forms up through the 40s and 50s. It was a hair removal treatment. And what they did was, this was back in the era when radiation was still a new enough discovery that it was thought to be pretty exciting and a great thing to put into consumer products. So, for example, in the 20s, you could buy radium-enhanced water coolers, for example. You could get radium beverages. And very famously, there was a case of an industrialist that got really hooked on this, and then he more or less fell apart as a result of his addiction to radium beverages. So the Trico system grew out of that era. The Trico system, what it was this cabinet that you would stick your arm in or you'd put your face up to this aperture, and a light would come on. There'd be a bit of a buzzing sound, and then, you know, 30 seconds later, you were done. And a week or two later, your excess hair would fall off. So if you were trying to get rid of hair on your forearms or, you know, over your lip or something like that, this is what they would do. Well, they were using x-rays. They were using fairly high-intensity x-rays to do this. And this actually, as you might guess, came to a very bad end. It's actually something that's been very obscure within medical literature, but there were some doctors that studied a number of people who had used this treatment. By the 1950s and 60s, they were seeing a lot of cases of cancer that had resulted from the Trico system. But no one had really written much on this. And so I got interested in it, started digging around a little bit into the history of this. And the guy behind it was a guy named Dr. Albert Geiser. And what I found was, this is something that would have been much harder to do in the past. By doing searches on professional publications, I was able to find when he graduated from medical school. I found out when he married. I was able to track, basically, a whole series of articles in the late 1890s and in the early part of the 1900s of increasingly dangerous experimentation with x-ray tubes and the use of x-ray medicine by Geiser and some of his colleagues, and his development of a low-intensity, so-called, x-ray tube that he thought could then be used for consumer purposes, because when you expose someone with it, they didn't immediately get radiation burns. So clearly it must be safe. I was then able to track his actually doing a stock offering, raising capital, opening the first parlors, the lawsuits that then resulted, and I found his name in the bankruptcy columns. And this, a lot of this sort of arc would have been fairly difficult to follow. He's not someone that would have been turning up very much in the Times Index, except possibly for his marriage. I found a number of Trico ads that were running at the time, both in classified sections and display ads. these wouldn't have been indexed anywhere. That's the only thing you can get through just sheer text crunching, where you have OCR, optical character recognition type of software, just going through enormous amounts of archived newspapers. And so I was able to draw out this whole story of the tree ecosystem that hadn't been a story written on it in decades. And in part, it was because the materials just really weren't there. It really couldn't have been written decades ago. Just to give you a somewhat more detailed example of this, about a year ago, I did a piece for the New York Times about something I'd remembered from my childhood. And what I remembered, I'll pull this up here, is this. I remembered seeing paperbacks when I was a kid that had cigarette advertising in them, which sounds really bizarre now. And those, some of you who are either spend a lot of time hanging out in flea markets or who are older mm-hmm. are nodding in recognition of this. When you would buy paperbacks in like the early and mid 1970s, you would often find stuff like this. You'd find that. I'll just pull up another example here. There's another Cantad. This is in a Voigt book called Quest for the Future. So it shows up in like sort of science fiction, just very popular paperback kind of mass publication type of stuff. They weren't the only types of ads. I'll pull up two other examples really quickly from the same book, actually. You would also see ads for Sanka. And of course, to finish the caffeine and cigarettes trilogy, you'd also find ads for booze. Now, I was describing this to someone a couple years ago, and they kind of didn't believe me, the idea that there used to be advertising in books. And not just like advertising somewhere on the back cover or something like that, but actually bound directly into the middle of the book. And I got curious about this. I thought, how did this come about, and why don't we have it now? So I started digging around. At first, I just started looking in the New York Times Historical Archive. They have all their papers from 1851 on up, including the ads, all completely searchable. And one of the first things that came up was the name of a guy, Roy Benjamin, who ran a firm, it was Benjamin Associates or something like that, that was pushing the idea of advertising in paperbacks. Fair enough. I did a bit more digging on his name and his firm name, and by every time a name of anyone connected with him would come up, I'd start searching their name as well. If I found an address or a phone number for his company, I'd search that. And bit by bit, particularly from the advertising column in the Times from back then, I started finding this timeline that in the late 50s, Benjamin had been this kind of hotshot, Mad Men era Madison Avenue advertising executive. And he'd come up with this idea of putting advertising into books, which was actually kind of a Victorian idea in a way, but he revived it for that era. And what he did was initially, it turned out, he tried it out in Spock's Baby Care, which was the most popular paperback book at the time. They stuck it in there. Spock sued the company, Pocket Books, for putting advertising in his book. And he was especially PO'd because he was a doctor, and it looked like he was somehow endorsing Q-tips and these other products. It was actually, you know, baby products being advertised in these books. He took them to court. He lost. And the moment he lost, the Benjamin Company sent out a memo to a bunch of companies saying, literally, the floodgates have been opened. And you know, now it's open season on advertising in books. And so they started really aggressively hitting up advertisers to put ads into paperback books. And this was the result. Now, the people who responded the most were tobacco companies, because they had just been banned by the late 60s. They were getting banned from radio and TV advertising, so this was an area that they could move into. And I thought, where am I going to find stuff on that? And I remembered the University of California at San Francisco has the Legacy Tobacco Documents Collection. This is a result of lawsuits where they subpoenaed 40, at this point they have 40 million pages of documents there. Of tobacco memos, market studies, I mean, just basically emptying out the filing cabinets of every major tobacco company. So I started doing searches for Roy Benjamin's name. in that archive, that started turning up memos. And every time I'd find a memo, I'd search everybody else's name who was mentioned in the memo. And over the course of doing this, this sort of web of hundreds and hundreds of documents emerged that linked all these various executives who were involved in this. I found out how much they were charging for this advertising, how many books they were doing it in. Ultimately, Lorillard alone spent $3 million on advertising in paperback books over, I think, a 3 or 4 year period, and they did 540 million ad placements. I mean, for a while there, if you were buying a paperback book, you were buying a cigarette ad too, or three or four. And so in the course of doing this, I was also finding, I'll pull up another example here. This is some of the stuff that came up from their documents. They also got involved in publishing ventures. For example, this is the Benjamin Company, trying to push the idea of a book called It's Safe to Smoke. They later also got involved, or the Lorillard Company actually, in their case, got involved in trying to plant favorable book reviews relating to cigarettes and relating to the tobacco industry in publications like the San Francisco Examiner. That was actually in the 1980s, so this went fairly late. Another quick example of the stuff that turned up, this is a book order. To give you some sense of the kind of numbers involved, this is just 1 month's order for one company. So this is the Lorillard Company. And scroll down just a little bit here. So here's how many copies we're talking about of different books, just for February 1972. You'll notice, incidentally, about five or six down, they put cigarette ads in 74,000 copies of The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. So no one was safe. And in fact, what I found in looking through these memos was I found a number of authors who didn't even know that this had been done. One of Michael Frayn's books had ads put in them, and I contacted him and I asked him what he thought of this, and he was kind of horrified. He didn't know that they'd even done this. This was being done without the author's knowledge. They weren't being paid. It was pretty terrible, actually. And I also came across a memo that indicated some resistance from Dave Marsh, who was a critic for Rolling Stone and was doing like a rock book of lists type of thing. And so I called him up. He did know about the ads, and as it turned out, his publisher, he was in on a publishing venture with Pete Townsend. And he complained to Pete Townsend, and Pete said, okay. So they didn't run the ads. So the story wound up coming together out of a combination of being able to dig through the Times archive, through the tobacco memos, and just old-fashioned sort of shoe leather reporting as far as calling people around. I called the Authors Guild and asked for their like retired board members who remembered, you know, fighting with these companies back in the day. And that's basically how the story came together. And virtually none of this could have worked a couple decades ago. I might have found a few ad execs or publishers who kind of remembered what had gone on, but I wouldn't have had access to these documents. I wouldn't have been able to trace out the timeline involved and who was involved, who was getting paid how much for it. And so, to me, this story really stood out as an example of how you can actually change the way that history gets written. Specifically, to me, for all the wonderful other technologies that have come along, OCR technology has changed things because I'm no longer beholden to finding aids, to the Palmer Index, to the Times of London, or to the Times Index, or to the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature, or to anyone else's notion of what is worthy of an index entry. The only thing I need is a name or a number. And if I plug it in and I'm looking for it, I can find it. And that radically changes the range of what you can write about as a result. So, anyway, thank you. Great.